Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of October 17th, 2014. Frontier mythology is a particularly American kind of storytelling. It runs under so many of the founding narratives of our country, moving out beyond established boundaries, pushing the envelope, both literally and in the way we approach our lives and businesses. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. This week on the show, we're talking about frontiers, when we choose to move or don't, how industries find new audiences. Even the white space on your TV dial you probably didn't know was a digital frontier. Come share your stories on the edge. You can find us at marketplaceweekend.org or on Twitter at MarketplaceWKND. And now let's get things going and round up your economic week in 20 seconds.
Markets have turned a lot more volatile after a several-year period of very low volatility. We've had volatility in both directions.
The number of Americans filing new claims for jobless benefits fell to a 14-year low last week.
Speaking at the Time Warner Investor Day, the chief executive officer of HBO announced the pay TV channel would launch a standalone online streaming version of its service next year.
From the new frontier in entertainment TV, I want to talk about what's next in sports broadcasting. High school. College football is already big business on TV. And now, Illinois-based Paragon Marketing Group is working on a deal to bring some type of high school football championship to a national audience. The group brought LeBron James high school basketball games to TV. They're in negotiations with several states and ESPN to televise a football playoff. ESPN wouldn't comment on the discussions, and Paragon said the talks are ongoing and private. Still, we wondered about the money and ethics behind putting high school players on TV. To put this in context, we went to high school football practice in Queens. This is the St. Francis High School squad. Legendary NFL coach Vince Lombardi went to St. Francis. So did longtime New York Yankees manager Joe Torre. Today, the football team practices at a park. The coaches are volunteers with day jobs, including coach Rich Carroll.
Well, we're here at 73rd Avenue and Francis Lewis Boulevard. This is where St. Francis Prep High School football has practiced now since the early 70s. And we set up a practice setting where we can almost create a game setting. So as you can see, we set up the lines and have the captains orchestrate a warm-up drill.
How do you think about them? Do you think about them as kids? Do you think about them as players? Who are these people out here in helmets?
Well, you know, it's funny because as a football coach at this age, I always say it's very difficult to walk around at the age they're at because they pretty much know everything, you know? And I only know a little bit as a football coach. I'm in my 40s. I've been around the program since the 80s when I played here. And at this age, it's really an interesting age to deal with high school kids. Really, they're at a very integral part of their lives that they're starting to develop who they really are, who their personalities are, what their identity will be for the rest of their lives.
We're looking at a lot of the money and the attention that is starting to trickle down into the high school level. You know, you sort of saw the college frontier. That was conquered a long time ago. College football is a huge business now. What do you think about the idea that people are putting high school football on TV?
Well, you know, it's really the bottom line is football's fun. It's fun for the players. It's fun for the parents. It's fun for the spectators. So I think the fact that even though there's a lot of negative press that goes along with football, the fact that it's so enjoyable to watch and it really is an opportunity, and we say this as coaches, football might be the last sport where we'll take the obese kid and try to make something out of him as far as athletics go. And as we all know, there's a huge obesity problem here in this country, and we're still looking for that big kid, and we'll work with him to try to work him into some sort of athletic shape where I don't think you're getting that in any other sport.
When you see something like, say, televised high school football on ESPN or Fox Sports 1, and the idea that suddenly there are going to be uniforms and maybe shoes and things like that coming into a program, What do you think that does to a high school football program?
I think it's promoting activity. I think it's promoting the youth to actually get involved and to be part of something bigger than themselves. And, you know, what it does for a program, I think it attracts more kids to get involved. It attracts more kids to get, you know, to get out and participate. And it's a physical sport, and it attracts kids to be a little more physical.
Do you think there's too much money in high school football?
No, I don't think there's enough money in high school football, and I'm going to tell you why. Out of all the coaches that are out here coaching, there's, I think, one or two coaches that are actually teachers within a school. They're all firemen. I have a plumber on my staff, police officers, all guys that are given their time to mold these youths. They're not getting paid well enough to be doing what they're doing for the youth. They're no different than teachers as far as I'm concerned. I'm out here from 3 o'clock till 6:30 with my guys. You know, every day I have a kid from 3 to 6:30. That's more than any history teacher, any math teacher. I have a bigger impact on that kid's life than any teacher will have as far as time.
What kind of pressure, then, does that financial situation put on you as a coach?
Oh, it is a financial pressure, and it is a big commitment, and it is a big sacrifice for all these coaches out here, all high school coaches everywhere, to be involved.
That was St. Francis High School football coach Rich Carroll. In a moment, we'll talk about the demand for a nationally televised high school football playoff, right here on Marketplace Weekend. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We just heard one high school football coach say televising high school games could be a good thing for programs like his. So far, one state has signed on to a deal to broadcast a national high school playoff, Florida. Meanwhile, two other big football states, Georgia and Texas, have declined for now. And even if a deal isn't reached to bring a national high school football playoff to TV, there are still games occasionally televised on Fox and ESPN. As high school athletes get better and better, that's where coaches and TV cameras are looking.
For the next frontier to be high school football is not a surprise.
That's sports business analyst Keith Reed.
You've already seen some media properties develop that cover high school football. You look at Max Preps is probably the most famous example of this, where you've actually got people feeding in information in real time, volunteers who do this, who go to high school football games and feed in the box scores and the stat lines. I was standing next to him. I've got a son who plays linebacker here in Connecticut. And there was a guy standing there watching our game and feeding stats into Max Prep at live as it happened, right? People
wow.
pay attention to this.
If you think back to, say, when LeBron James was playing high school basketball, Paragon Marketing Group, which is a big, you know, sports marketing group, they do other events as well. They brokered a deal for his high school game to be played on ESPN, too, and it was huge. So I think about that, and yet I think, wait a minute, are these players or are they kids?
Well, if you're talking about somebody at the level of a LeBron James, right, and that's only going to come around once in a generation. I mean, you're probably not going to see another kid with as much hype or with as much ability as LeBron James in the next, you know, 10 to 15 years, if not 20 to 25 years. So I think that's a little bit of an anomaly. But there is already sort of a two-tiered system that exists for the star high school athlete versus the run-of-the-mill player who's in his last year, you know, last hurrah in doing this for the letter on his jacket.
Are you concerned at all about, say, ESPN or Fox or whoever televises a game? Are they just exploiting kids, putting those games out there?
If you've got an ESPN, if you've got a regional sports network, if you start to build the kind of money into high school athletics, and money is already there, but it's nowhere near what it is at the college level, of course. But if you start to build that kind of money and that kind of interest in the high school sports where people are, you know, where you're selling rights to the games, where you're, you know, where it no longer costs, you know, just the cursory $5 to get in to see your kid play, but it's $20 a ticket or something like that. And there's a real revenue machine. And again, I'm speaking not only as an analyst of the business of sports, but I'm speaking as somebody who's got a kid actively playing high school sports, right? So I'm emotionally invested in this. What I'm not okay with is the idea that somebody comes along and they're making a ton of money that my kid never sees as he goes to practice and comes home sore and is work, you know, and that sort of thing, right? That you know, you're not creating a situation where there are people who have the ability to be able to exploit the high school athlete like, in my opinion, the college athlete has been exploited for so long.
Sports business analyst Keith Reed, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me. Go Warriors! I had to sneak that one in, right?
And that brings us to the weekend number. 10 grand, as in $10,000. That's how much Paragon Marketing Group will pay the Florida High School Athletic Association for allowing the state schools to participate in a national playoff or bowl series, according to their contract. If two or more teams are chosen from the state, the Florida High School Athletic Association would receive $40,000, with the high schools receiving $12,500 for appearing and another $25,000 in merchandising fees. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
I'm Dr. Emmett Brown. I'm standing on the parking lot at Twin Pines Mall. It's Saturday morning, October 26, 1985, 1:18 a.m., and this is temporal experiment number one.
This is tech in real life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
So I gather that you want to talk to me about white space?
Yes.
What is white space?
Okay, so a lot of people think white space is going to be very important to our sort of connected near future. And in some ways, it already is. So it's this spectrum that's actually in between broadcast spectrum being used by TV broadcasters. Think about it this way.
I'm making a confused face.
Yes,
that
you're
people
making
on the radio
a confused
can't,
face.
But can't see because we're on the radio.
But I'm going to make it into a happy face.
Okay.
So think about when you're changing channels on like an older television, right? And
yes.
Sometimes some channels you get, some channels you get that snowy look.
Right. Okay.
That's
sure.
TV
we're
white space.
Ourselves, but yes. Okay.
You could
it.
Also think of it as sort of like almost like a rainbow of different channels. And in between each color of the rainbow is a white space. And this is basically unused spectrum that TV broadcasters put there so that they could actually make sure there were strong borders between channels, for instance.
Oh.
And also just sort of it's unused space. Now, this is, of course, changing because we all want to be super connected and use up as much bandwidth as possible all the time. And part of that means that we need to change the rules of the road, so to speak, for broadcast. And the Federal Communications Commission is looking at this right now, as are other countries.
Okay, so this is all very pretty. We've got rainbows.
Yes.
Colliding
yes.
with government regulators and the FCC.
It's beautiful.
How does this impact my life? Make
okay.
me care.
All right. How do you feel about meerkats?
I like meerkats.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I like meerkats too.
They're very cute.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we're starting to test out the use of this white space stuff. And the London Zoo is actually working with the FCC's regulatory equivalent across the pond over in Britain to test the use of TV white space. It's got a 24/7 streaming YouTube channel of the meerkat exhibit because, you know, the internet loves cats, obviously. And here's something else I think you should think about. Think about the Wi-Fi in our office. Right? If you and I are go like far enough away from the router, our Wi-Fi signal goes down, right?
Yes.
Now, the kind of broadcast waves that we would be using for white space is actually way more powerful. So white space waves can actually go up to 6 miles. So there's another idea that we could actually use this stuff to create super powerful Wi-Fi. And that's why countries are starting to test this to see if we can actually find ways to share this open white space, because it could be huge for that sort of thing.
Now, so the meerkats could just go on and on and on.
Forever. They're actually talking about using white space to deliver internet broadband on the open ocean, which
wow.
I think is
okay.
really interesting. And or using it for networks of sensors that can protect cities from natural disasters, for instance. Kind of interesting.
Because often we've seen when there is a disaster, I've been in hurricanes or other things like that, networks get overloaded very quickly.
They do get overloaded very quickly. And perhaps in some cases, more importantly, we don't know, for instance, that a tsunami or something like that is coming. And if we can build sensor networks that a lot of people are talking about and have those networks exist on open white space waves, then we can actually have this stuff warn us earlier.
Does any of this mean we will have a faster, better internet in the future?
Well, it depends a little bit on what the FCC and other regulators decide to do with the open space. And they're actually talking about this right now and establishing rules and things like that. Now, some of these tests, like the Meerkat cameras, prove we can use white spaces without interfering with channels. Like, if that actually works out, what we might see in some cases is actually using this for providing internet where there isn't internet already. So in case we were like traveling in a super rural area, for instance, or a place where there wasn't as much infrastructure for internet, there might be through white space.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech, thank you so much. Let's go watch some meerkats.
All right, let's do it.
Get some of our tech in your life. Download the Marketplace app. You can pick it up in the iTunes store or on Google Play. This week, we're talking about frontiers, a fitting theme for our next story, about a naturalist who lives way up in the mountains of Boone, North Carolina. Eustace Conway has been living in the forest there for nearly 40 years.
My birthday gave me the point where I was like, well, I'm 17 now, I can go out on my own, you know, I'm old enough now. And so that's the day I walked out into the forest and started living in a teepee and being hungry and touching reality. Well, at that time, I didn't need any money. It wasn't anything to do with the money. You could wipe your ass or blow your nose or start a fire, and that's about all good for. Out here in this forest with this lifestyle, other than like paying land taxes, if you just take it down to living, money is meaningless. It's nothing. It is not even a concern, not even a thought. It's no good. You could have piles of it. Doesn't do anything. You could drop me anywhere in the world, and even if it was a desert or a beach somewhere that I wasn't even familiar, I could survive fairly well, and it's because I carry with me knowledge in my head, you know, and it's something that you can't lose. It doesn't matter if it gets rained on. It's not going to fade. It's something that's inside of my hands and my brain. It's an ability, knowledge of how to interact with the world, to make and fix anything that I need. And that's a real insurance policy, and that's real peace. You know, like I know that I can deal with it, whatever. Life doesn't have to cost you a bunch. You know, it doesn't have to cost hardly anything. I'm certainly not worried. I have started thinking about it now that I'm getting closer to old age. My hair is white, you know, and I'm thinking about it, but not worried. Basically, my skills can help me manifest whatever I need out in this forest environment. Here's the bottom line. If I get old and die, I don't care. I'll just rot back into the ground. It suits me fine to feed one of the trees that's been helping me, you know. I'm a part of the forest, and if I melt back into it, that's okay. I've succeeded at everything that I've gone about, maybe other than finding a wife that suits me for a lifelong companion, but like I wouldn't want to change my way of living for anything.
Eustace Conway has hiked the entire Appalachian Trail and crossed the U.S. on horseback from the Atlantic to the Pacific. He spoke to us from his home on Turtle Island Preserve in Boone, North Carolina. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. And since it's the weekend, we asked some friends to join us. So let's have brunch. We are out having brunch at the Pullman Kitchen in New York. And today we've got a special edition, an all-business insider brunch. We've got Joe Weisenthal, the executive editor, and Nicholas Carlson, chief correspondent, both from Business Insider. Welcome to you both.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Cheers.
High five.
Cheers.
Or high five. You know, yeah. Either way, man. The roller coaster ride that is the stock market right now. Joe, what is going on?
Yeah, it's exciting times. In the span of just a few weeks, we've gone from everybody being bullish, nobody having any reason to thinking stocks would sell, to nobody is bullish, markets tanking like we haven't seen in a long time, big like 2 and 3% down days.
Nick, put this into real people perspective for me, because I think if you're someone who, you know, has a retirement account and maybe wants to stop working, you live through the financial crisis, you look at this again and go, oh, God, right. Is my money safe?
Right. So, I mean, I think the best advice really would be to turn your TV off and close the blogs.
Only
and,
listen to public radio.
Yeah, but
turn off the radio.
Go listen to
No, turn on the radio. On the radio.
Listen to lots
Sorry.
Of radio.
Got that wrong.
But don't get caught up in the up and downs. This is exciting for people like Joe, because Joe's watching this all the
Joe's
time.
Joe's a dork.
You know, but this is not exciting. This is probably stressful. Don't pay that close of attention to it, probably, for those people.
People need to be reminded that we could have a downturn, we could have a sell-off, we could have an economic slowdown without it feeling like economic Armageddon, which is how we all felt in 2008 and 2009. At that time, we really thought, this, like, could this be the end of the modern capitalist system as we know it, the collapse of the entire financial system?
Well, that's
but the truth of the matter is, like, before that, you know, mild recessions and downturns are not that rare. In fact, that's just part of the business cycle.
I want to talk about a big transition in the way we consume popular culture. We have been talking a lot on this show about the transition away from traditional broadcast TV. HBO has come out and made this announcement. We're going to offer a web-only something. Sounds kind of like HBO Go, but just on the web, kind of like Netflix, maybe. What is this? Is this a game changer, do you think, Nick?
I think it's really big news. People will start to say that this means that cable bundling is going to go away. But, I mean, until the big thing that keeps that from ever happening is...
Sports.
Sports. ESPN. And, you know, those things are... You start to get into ad-supported businesses that aren't just subscription-supported like HBO is. And so it's a big changer for HBO, and it's a big changer for premium content channels, but it's not going to change the cable paradigm.
Yeah, to me, what's exciting about all these things like HBO Go is just how nice of an experience it is. If you have a set-top box and you have cable, how miserable it is, like, that we still, like, flip through channels that have numbers, and we have to, like, scroll through them vertically or whatever. Like, that's it. And then when you go to an app like HBO Go or Netflix, it's like, you search by show, and it's just really easy to get around and see exactly what you want to see. So I think, like, it's really exciting that there will be more of these kind of options where we're accustomed to getting content this way. But in terms of, like, it being a collapse of the traditional TV model, I'm sure that'll happen eventually, but I don't think this is the thing that will set it off.
I wonder if there's something that takes away spontaneity in this, and I can't believe I'm actually going to advocate for channel flipping, but...
I love channel flipping.
There's something, I think, where you can stumble upon something you never expected that...
Well, I've had a lot of, like,
kind of nice
sick days where I spent the afternoon just watching, like, a Law and Order marathon.
Oh, I've
or
watched every
like
episode of SVU ever made.
You know, that might not happen in the area. Like, that happens because I'm flipping through and I see that. That might not happen, you know, if I, you know,
they talk about a thing called decision fatigue, which, you know, you maybe you only have like something like a 15 decisions you can make in a day before just exhausting your brain. So the idea of you always having to go on and pick what you want to watch, it can be exhausting. I don't know if you've ever like had this experience where you turn on Netflix and you're like, okay, what do I watch? Nah, that's not going to be good enough. No, I've seen something like that before. And just being able to just turn on the TV and it's already streaming and it's going, it can be very pleasant, especially if you just sort of know whatever channel you're turning on.
I think it also is very important to see what kind of price point these companies are operating at. If they are selling something that is a premium product at a premium price,
right,
that may be out of a lot of people's reach. I mean,
because you're not going to just want to have one. You're not going to just have HBO. You're going to want to have the HBO app or the Netflix app. And, you know,
Showtime,
eventually you'll want to have, like, maybe the MLB service or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you're, you know, by the time you add all those together, you've basically just recreated what you're paying for when you get cable.
The week that I have two dudes on the show, I'm going to ask you about women in the workplace and two major companies, Facebook and Apple, talking about paying for, essentially, egg freezing for female employees, implementing it in different timelines in each company. But this marks a big shift in the way we talk about women in the workforce. You're both men, so you're going to come at this from a slightly different viewpoint than I do. But what do you think about this announcement in terms of both women in the workforce and how this positions these companies from a competitive standpoint?
I think from a competitive standpoint, it's a clear winner for them. So they're basically saying, you know, if you want to, they want, these companies want to attract women. They want to attract women who are very alpha and career oriented and not going to slow down. So, you know, I think from their perspective, it's a winner.
I also find it to be a very interesting thing coming on the heels of Satya Nadella's, how should we put this?
Oh, God.
Big foot in his mouth telling women not to ask for a raise.
I think that someone said this on Twitter, so not an original thought, but I think it struck me as correct, which was, I think for a moment he forgot he was at a women's conference and was just giving advice to all employees. Sort of, don't ask for a raise. You really shouldn't do that. We'll take care of you, which is maybe something he thinks CEOs should just, you know, what any CEO would do. But that's actually really bad advice.
It's really bad advice.
Yeah, and it makes you wonder about his career and how he got to where he is and things like that.
I think it's probably bad advice for you know, both genders.
Oh,
but
absolutely.
It's particularly bad advice for women.
It is.
You know, when you see study after study after study showing that you have to advocate in a very specific
way. It's an unfortunate
way.
Fact of, like, workforces that if you're noisier and ask for more, you'll probably get more, regardless. And so you end up with pay that just skewed not necessarily on merit, but towards the noisy.
I have to throw one thing at you guys. The New York Times wrote a piece saying brunch is for jerks. Are we jerks?
You know what? I clicked on that, and I read the headline, and I immediately clicked away. I was like,
you're a jerk, is what you're saying.
It just seemed like such a transparently trolly move
that
I wasn't going to indulge it, that I wasn't going to indulge the piece by reading it. I saw the headline, and I was like, life is too short, I'm going to die one day, and I'll regret if I spent time reading this piece. So I don't know if the argument is valid or not.
My view was, I, on Saturday morning, like to have a big cheesy omelet, some bacon, some toast. Call it what you will, you know, point at me, laugh.
I enjoy a long, leisurely meal that, you know, stretches on, may or may not involve an alcoholic beverage at 11 o'clock. I think that is perfectly
You know what I am anti, though, is like the whole waiting outside of a restaurant.
So I saw there was a great tweet a while back from Tim Carney, and he said, some people have brunch and some people have kids. And that was like a pretty, and that's how he divided his friends. And that seems pretty accurate.
All right, Joe Weisenthal and Nicholas Carlson from Business Insider, thank you both so much.
Real pleasure. Thank you.
Last week on the show, we asked you about where you live and why. Mobility and finding a new frontier have always had special economic resonance for Americans. But according to the U.S. Census, fewer Americans moved this past year within the U.S. than ever before, basically since they started keeping records. This is Andrew Morrison talking about what made him settle down in a tiny house in southern Oregon.
Hi, my name's Andrew Morrison, and I live in a 207-square-foot tiny house. It's actually quite spacious. It has tall ceilings, and we've never actually felt cramped in it. We have everything we need here. We have a full-size kitchen. In fact, our kitchen is bigger than some of our friends' kitchens who live in, you know, regular houses. It's quite comfortable space. We have a bathroom with a shower and the whole setup, and it has all of the amenities, and we really don't feel like there's a lot of compromise that we have to make. It just simplifies our lives. My wife and I work out of our house, so not only is it a 207-square-foot house, but it also doubles as our office. We kind of thought we would have a little bit of withdrawals at some level from full-size housing, but we really don't. I think we're very comfortable here. All of our needs are met, and if anything, I think that there are added benefits of living here in terms of our family communication is much better. Our relationships are much more much closer. We had lived in a number of houses. We kind of had the American dream house before we lived here. Beautiful, you know, 2,000 square foot home, roughly. We started our journey towards tiny about 3 years ago and sold or donated most of what we own, got rid of our house, and went down to Mexico and lived on the beach in Mexico for 5 months, and then came back and continued our journey. But we own 5.5 acres up in the country, and it's just a beautiful spot, and really don't see any reason for us to move.
Everyone can stay put in a 270-square-foot home, but fewer Americans are moving, pushing those frontier boundaries. We wanted to understand why and what that means for the economy as a whole. So we called Nicholas Retsinas, a professor of real estate at Harvard Business School. Thank you for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
We put this out there to a number of our listeners, asking them why they live where they live. And I want to play a couple of pieces of tape for you, because I think what we hear is little stories that tell us something about the economy as a whole. Let's listen to Allison.
Well, I'm living in Jacksonville, Florida. It's actually the city I was born in, the city my mom was born in. She came back, she went to college, came back when, you know, I was born here after she got married. My wife and I sold our house and had a house built here in Jacksonville, so that mom could live with us. She's not able to take care of herself. She's not able to live independently.
And then I want to listen to another person, and this is Don Esri.
Well, I live in Columbus, Ohio. I am an East Coast native, and I was a reporter at a smallish newspaper south of Boston where I grew up. And I wanted to get a better and bigger job. So I had applied all over the place, and this was the job in the city that called me back. Never been to Columbus before, never had really thought about Ohio, had no sense of what it was, but thought I'd spend a couple of years here, and 4 years later, I'm still here.
Nicholas Retsinas, we are hearing these stories about moving to the place where you can find a job or taking care of a parent, being a caregiver. What do those tell you about the economy right now and why Americans live where they live?
I think those two little clips were very interesting because in some ways they reflect what has been an ongoing tug of war between mobility and stability. Over the years, this country has often been noted as a country of high mobility, where people are willing and able and interested in move to other places, particularly for economic reasons. But over the last 30 years, that mobility has gone down a bit. In part, understanding why is it's hard to say. There are clearly some economic reasons. certainly the fact that we don't have an economy growing good enough jobs that people are willing to be attracted to and risk moving to another place. Certainly the collapse of the housing market and the fact that so many people owe more than what their home is worth is another reason overall. But I think it probably reflects a broader societal issue that people wrestle with. Are they comfortable kind of where they are? Does it have the right kind of networks, the right kind of people, the right kind of proximity to family? Or do they have the wanderlust to go to, whether it's Columbus or Silicon Valley or wherever they want to go? So I think it is this sort of tug of war that takes place in our country.
We have these pretty striking census numbers. And when you contrast that with where we were in the 1950s, it's just about half. What do you think that says about Americans?
Well, part of it has to do with, it's a boring answer, which is the demographic answer. We've gone through this crush of almost 80 million baby boomers. Baby boomers are now all over the age of 60 and 65, and they're starting to become in their late 60s. Those people historically have not moved as often as younger people. So just look at the basic sort of population numbers, the fact that we have a larger number of older people, that would lead you to believe the mobility rates would be less as a country as a whole. But what's maybe more interesting than that is as we look at the millennials, the people born right at the beginning, at the end of the last century and early on in this century overall, even their mobility rates are going down a little bit. And I think that relates to what I said before earlier, having to do with value of homes that they might have bought during the bubble, might have had to do with their nervousness about a job. So I think there are a lot of things swirling around.
When you talk to your students and you talk about real estate and creating communities, what do you see as the reasons people put down roots or decide to tear them out and go somewhere else?
Well, a lot of it, as we said, has to do with sort of the jobs they aspire to and where those jobs are. But a lot of it has to do with, I think, this notion of, I think, some concern about sort of losing that kind of family nexus, which maybe 50 years ago we didn't think about as much. But now it becomes much more relevant, I think, in an era where there's so much going on, so many questions about your future and your own sort of job stability. And I think about it in my own situation. I had a daughter who went to Alaska for work and did very well there and the like, but then she had children. And she thought, I don't have the network. I don't have the network behind me that I need to sort of support the raising of these children. So she kind of moved back to the East Coast.
Well, I can't do this interview without asking you why you live where you live.
In my case, it could be inertia. I live on the one hand, I live 2 miles from where I was born in Providence, Rhode Island. On the other hand, my job takes me around the world all the time. So it's nice to have a place that I know is secure. I know this is my roots. This is kind of where I am. Maybe I wouldn't feel that way if I had the wanderlust to travel, but I don't since I travel so much.
Nicholas Ritsinas, a professor of real estate at Harvard Business School. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
It's closing in on Halloween, so next week we're going to get financially spooky. We want to hear your stories of the scary side of finance. Have you ever fallen victim to a scam? What was that like for you? What'd you learn? Tell us about it by visiting MarketplaceWeekend.org or tweet us. We're at MarketplaceWKND. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. It may not have occurred to you, but Marketplace is a millennial. We're celebrating our 25th birthday this year, a fun frontier to cross. And we wanted to see how money has changed in those 25 years since we've started. Tobin Lowe is on our digital team here at Marketplace and dug up some numbers on what things cost now versus 25 years ago and what that tells us about our priorities. Hi, Tobin.
Thanks for having me.
So let's get into this. Marketplace is 25. You tracked how spending changed over the last 25 years. The show's millennial. We're talking millennials. You use the Consumer Expenditure Survey. Can you put that into English for me? What is that?
Sure. So it is a survey by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And basically, it tracks how much people spend annually on all sorts of things like rent, car-related expenses, food, basically anything you need to live your life gets tracked by the Bureau of Labor Statistics on this survey.
We should note that everything has been adjusted for inflation here. What were some of the biggest differences you found in what 20-somethings spend their money on 25 years ago versus today?
There were some obvious ones, so let's talk about renting versus owning. Owning is down about $300 annually, but renting is up a whopping $1,479 a year.
Wow.
Which makes sense. It's well documented that renting is a more feasible financial option for millennials, but I think there's something else here at play. If you think about what renting offers versus buying, so in terms of amenities, a lot of rental properties take care of things for you that you would have to worry about if you owned. Also, flexibility. So
You're the generation that doesn't want to own anything, right, man?
Exactly. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, millennials tend to stay with the same employer for about 3 years. So if you own a property, that impedes on your flexibility.
What else is in there? Let's talk about what you consume, food.
Yeah, food is way down. So annually, 20-somethings are spending about $1,152 less on food. And part of that has to do with food is just cheaper to make now. But also, I think it's really interesting when you start breaking it down into items, what we're spending less on just because of taste. So I really want to talk to you about milk.
Okay.
Can we talk about milk?
We can talk about milk. Tell me about milk.
Okay, so fresh milk and cream, we're spending $130 less on it a year.
Is that because we're drinking less milk?
No, and this is where the CE is really interesting to look at because you can sort of track cultural trends.
Okay.
Okay, so according to the USDA data, we're not drinking less milk, it's just our options are more.
Huh.
So if you think about the last 20-something years, we have soy milk, we have almond milk. I'm pretty sure if you can make milk out of flannel, it would sell out in my neighborhood in Brooklyn
in like two seconds. Yep.
So we just have a lot more options. So our consumption is the same, it's just that milk-like products have become more prevalent.
Okay. What else is in there?
Cereal is down $59 a year, and that makes sense because General Mills, their most recent quarterly earnings, profits down 25%, which is a lot.
Wow, yeah, that is a lot.
Yeah, and a lot of people are saying it's because people are more health conscious now. They're realizing sugar on top of bran flakes, not so healthy. And also, if you think about celiac disease, people are more aware of what goes into their body and what might be affecting them. So we're not eating as much cereal as we used to.
Let's get into one other area of expenditure that I think really tells us something about how an industry has changed, and that is costs related to reading. What did you find?
Yeah, costs related to reading, and this includes newspaper subscriptions, money spent on books and magazines, that sort of thing. Those are down $197 annually. And I think when you look at that number and you think about 1989 versus 2013, what's happened in that amount of time is e-readers, digital subscriptions, newspapers moving online, and that's significantly cheaper than paying for a paper subscription. So I think you see that those costs are coming way down. We're not necessarily reading less. I wouldn't say 20-somethings are reading less, but those costs are just way less.
Tobin Lowe from Marketplace's digital team. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
You can check out Marketplace's inflation calculator. It's on our website, marketplace.org. We at Marketplace aren't the only ones celebrating our 25th anniversary. Charlie's Bakery, a family business in Cape Town, South Africa, is also commemorating their 25th. The bakery, its employees, and most of all, its elaborate custom cakes are the stars of Charlie's Cake Angels, a reality show. Our partners at the BBC have the story of Jackie Beese and her daughter, Alex. They own and operate Charlie's. Jackie talks about the experience of growing her business into the success that it is today.
I started this business 25 years ago in 1989 with my husband Charlie. When people look at our business today, they think that it just suddenly grew into this great big business which exists now. But there have been many times over the past 25 years when it's been really hard and where it's been a struggle to pay the bills and to handle salaries. When business was hard, We could draw money from our bond and use that for the business. And our home got paid off and used up a number of times over the years. Since we have been in this building, which we moved into and purchased 5 years ago, we have grown our staff from 15 people to 41 people. And that has been over a time when the economy has been struggling. People always have birthdays. They're always getting married. There are always celebration times. And they will always celebrate and find something for the luxury. People may find that they spend less on an item. They may not go as extravagant. But we can offer our customer anything from a cupcake for 18.50 rand up to a wedding cake for thousands and thousands of rands. Working with my daughters in the business is particularly valuable because each of them has very different skills.
We do fight occasionally because we're human and we're family. And when we do, we sort it out immediately. There is something about a family business that everyone should know is the art of a good apology.
That's Jackie's daughter, Alex. She says the bakery's custom orders have run quite the gamut.
We do loads of different themed cakes. We can do anything from a little girl's My Little Pony cake to a guy who loves soccer with his favorite team on top. We've done some totally bizarre cakes, and we always get asked, what is the most bizarre cake that you've had to make? Genitalia. Human genitalia. What is up with people and wanting to get human genitalia cake? It is weird, but we do lots.
One thing that's changed Charlie's business model over the last 25 years is the rise of online marketing and ordering.
I'm very active on social media, and I use that to keep our business going. But the fascinating thing is that our website and our internet bring in, I reckon, at least 50% of the trade in our business. So we have three people constantly sitting on email, answering emails.
Jackie and Alex Bees, brought to us by our partners at the BBC. And that's it. That's Marketplace Weekend for this week. Next week, we'll have some brunch and hear your scary stories about getting scammed. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan and Jenny Ament, with help from John Sepulvedo. Dan Samatovich is our senior producer. Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.